I guess first, why don't you just state your full name?
Okay, my name is Richard F. Berry, go by Rick.
All right. And what was your, what was your duty station in Vietnam?
Vietnam, I had two actual duty stations. When I initially went to Vietnam, I joined the unit, A Company, 229th Assault Helicopter Battalion, 1st Cavalry Division, at a place called LZ English. LZ English was located in the northeastern portion of Tu Kor, along the coast, a place called the Bang Song Plain. And I was stationed there along with A Company until January of 1968. I arrived initially in May of 1967. We were at LZ English until January of 1968, and then A Company 229th, along with about two-thirds of the 1st Cavalry Division, moved north to I Corps and set up in a place called LZ Evans, also in the coastal plain, but farther north, obviously. And I served there until I came home in May of 1968.
All right. So what sort of duties did you participate in while you were stationed?
I enlisted for the Army's flight school. The Army had a program that allowed a guy to enlist for helicopter flight school. It's called the Warrant Officer Rotary Wing Aviator Course. Took about a year to complete that course of study, and just about everybody was assigned to an aviation unit either in Vietnam or on its way to Vietnam after completing flight school. So I was a warrant officer helicopter pilot in an assault helicopter company in Vietnam.
All right. What sort of helicopters did you fly?
I flew a helicopter called a Huey. The official name for it was a UH-1 Iroquois. When I first arrived, the unit was equipped with D model Hueys, UH-1D. About halfway through my tour, our D model Hueys were replaced with H model Hueys. The only difference between the two aircraft was a 300 horsepower increase in the power of the engine, which is really quite significant, actually, because it gave us much more power, particularly for operations in the mountains.
All right. And so what sort of missions would you fly while you were piloting the Huey? I mean, you said you were in an assault helicopter battalion, but, I mean, what sort of missions were carried out?
Well, I guess, we had a number of missions. The three missions that we obtained most of our flight time were either combat assaults, air mobile assaults, where we would carry light infantry into landing zones. That was a very coordinated operation. And once the infantry was on the ground, one of our aircraft would be assigned to support the unit in the field. We called that flying logistics. The infantry also often referred to that as the log bird. We sometimes called it flying ash and trash. That was a single ship mission where you essentially spent the day flying back and forth from the field to the infantry unit's logistics pad at their base camp. And you essentially spent the day hauling the unit in the field, whatever they needed to continue their operation. Food, water, ammunition, replacements, mail, maybe hot chow for their last meal of the day. And the third major mission we flew would be extractions, where you essentially brought the field unit back to their base camp. And most of our flight time was involved one of those three different items. We also had other missions we flew on a less regular basis, one of which would be emergency resupply missions at night, where we would bring ammunition to a unit in the field. And that would become necessary because the unit in the field was either involved with ground combat at that time or they had recently been in contact. The unit commander of the infantry unit decided he wanted to be resupplied with ammunition before daylight. So rather than the logistics burden the next day hauling ammunition out to the unit, there'd be an on-call emergency resupply at night that would do it. We also inserted long-range reconnaissance patrols, called LRP team insertions. And then the third mission that we had, third combat mission, we call the lightning bug mission, sometimes called firefly mission. That was also at night, and that involved one of our Hueys along with two helicopter gunships and a fixed-wing aircraft called an OV-1 Mohawk. The OV-1 Mohawk had side-looking airborne radar, and the pilot could pass real-time information of something moving on the ground to the aircraft that I would be flying in. You would go over to that spot. In our aircraft, we had flares we could drop. We also had a cluster of C-130 landing lights that were operated by the crew chief. But what we essentially would do would be to illuminate the ground in the area where the OV-1 Mohawk told us something was moving. And in that particular area, there was a curfew of movement at night. So theoretically, anything moving at night could be considered the enemy, although we always identified it specifically as the enemy. But then the gunships were there to attack the item on the ground if it turned out to be the enemy. Then another sort of mission we flew would be non-combat flying. Might involve something like moving a USO troop from one secure area to another. VIP type missions, and that's pretty much the sum of it.
All right. Well, you mentioned for a couple of your missions involved a lot of night flying. How was that done? Like, what kind of special equipment was utilized?
Night flying in Vietnam was really quite dangerous, and that had to do with the fact that, well, there are two reasons. One, of course, we had no night vision goggles at all. Also, this is all visual flight rules type flying, where the pilots are maintaining their spatial orientation by looking primarily outside the aircraft. And the problem with flying at night in Vietnam, and other than really quite good weather, is that there were absolutely no lights on the ground once you left the base camp area. So if you had a night with a solid overcast weather-wise, it really became quite difficult to see the ground. It became quite difficult to see the horizon, and therefore very easy to get into a situation that's called pilot vertigo or spatial disorientation, where the person flying essentially loses the correct perception of up and down. And that can happen to a pilot no matter what their skill level. It could happen to a pilot without the individual even realizing it was happening, and you would very quickly lose control of the aircraft. I have personal knowledge of two aircraft like the ones I flew that were flown into the ground at night by pilots that simply lost their frame of reference. It was less than ideal weather, and they just flew the helicopters into the ground. So flying at night was quite difficult. It's really what made those emergency resupplies missions kind of dangerous. In addition to that aspect of it, we would always make the approach into the landing zone in the field with no lights. And it really didn't matter how dark it was, we would make a lights out approach. The reason for that is that we were going out there specifically because the enemy was in the area, and turning your landing light on when you were low and slow was not a smart thing to do. So we would shoot the approach lights out to an infantryman who was in the landing zone. He had a flashlight with a red lens, and they got to be pretty good at shining the flashlight up the glide slope that you would use to make the approach. But the pucker factor associated with the whole situation was the lights out approach into the landing zone.
Just for future reference, what do you mean by pucker factor?
Pucker factor is well, essentially, you're scared about what it amounts to.
All right. So all of the operations that you carried out, seems like they need, they required a lot of, I guess, logistical communication between the air, the ground, and all the other types. So what sort of things were utilized, I guess, to maintain lines of communication between the air and the ground?
Well, it kind of started with the whole concept of the 1st Cavalry Division. I guess I feel quite fortunate to have flown for the 1st Cavalry Division as opposed to some other unit in Vietnam, basically because the entire field operation of the 1st Cavalry Division was oriented around the use of helicopters. So the helicopters were used to assault the troops in the field, they were used to bring them out of the field, they were used to resupply them while they were in the field, and because the entire field operation of the infantry was oriented around the use of helicopters, the guys on the ground became quite knowledgeable about the capabilities of the aircraft and the capabilities of the pilot. There's a lot of trust and cooperation that took place between the infantry and the aviation units. As far as communications, we had three different radios in the aircraft. One that we used to talk to the ground or to the infantry units was almost always an FM radio. That's because the ground units had a backpack FM radio, well, a PRC-25 or PRC-25. They had their own radio frequency, and that's really what we would use to talk to the guys on the ground.
All right. So from a logistical standpoint, you know, what sort of coordination would there have to be for, like, say, like a larger mission? Like if like an operation was to go on for more than one day or over the course of a day, including a lot of infantry, like, would there be some kind of overseeing, like, aircraft or anything like that?
Now, there often was, particularly with a combat assault. So the unit that I flew for was an assault helicopter company. We would actually carry the infantry into the landing zone. Above the landing zone would be another Huey, not from our unit, that would be called the command and control aircraft. In the cargo compartment of that helicopter would typically be the battalion commander, the infantry unit involved, probably be a lieutenant colonel. There would also be the infantry unit's operations officer. There would also be a liaison officer for the artillery. The flight leader from our group of helicopters would be in radio communication, usually with the operations officer in the Huey above the landing zone. They, for example, would coordinate the arrival time of the formation in the landing zone with the initial lift of infantry. That was really important because on a full prep combat assault, the landing zone would be struck by 1st Cav artillery before the troop-carrying aircraft, the Slicks that I flew, would bring the infantry into the landing zone. So the flight leader and our group of probably five Hueys would negotiate on arrival time in the landing zone with the operations officer in the command and control helicopter. They would actually synchronize the clocks in the two helicopters. Our company commander led most of those full prep assaults. He tells me that he was unhappy with himself if he missed that agreed to arrival time in the landing zone by more than plus or minus 5 seconds. So it was closely timed. Of course, the reason for that had to do with the fact that there was artillery being shot into the landing zone for two reasons, really. The first one, of course, being the potential for the enemy to be present in the landing zone. We were also concerned about booby traps, particularly back in the hills and the upland area to the west of the coastal plain where most of these full prep assaults took place. So artillery into the landing zone would have a tendency to set off any booby traps that might be there. And that artillery prep was timed so that it lasted until the formation was 1 minute out of the landing zone based on the agreed to arrival time, the last round fired by the artillery into the landing zone would be white phosphorus. And when we saw that white smoke in the landing zone, we knew that the artillery tubes were clear and it was safe for the formation to land. But the guys fly in, the troop carrying helicopters like myself would not be involved in any of that. All that interaction would take place between the flight leader and the command and control helicopter. The pilots in the other aircraft in the formation would simply be worried about maintaining their proper spot in the formation and flying the aircraft properly and so forth.
All right. What kind of formations did you fly? Like, were there specific formations per type of mission? I know you mentioned earlier that for one of the night missions that you would fly with two additional aircraft and then a fixed wing observation craft.
Right, but there really wasn't a formation involved there. Those four aircraft, well, the two gunships would stay within sight of each other. Those four aircraft would be widely separated. We used two kinds of formations. One was a trail formation, which is exactly what it sounds like. It's just one aircraft right behind the other. The pilots would maintain a trail formation by lining up the tail rotor gearbox with the exhaust of the aircraft that they were flying formation on. We use a trail formation going into pickup zones on assaults and into landing zones on extractions. And the reason for that had to do with infantry approaching the aircraft on the ground. So we would maintain the trail formation right into the landing area, set down one behind the other. That would cause the infantry to approach the helicopters from the sides at pretty much a 90 degree angle and greatly reduce the likelihood of one of the grunts walking into a tail rotor. That's specifically why we did it. And that was really quite easy to do. We seldom shut down in the landing areas. There's a bunch of noise. The tail rotors are tough to see when they're turning. Some of the infantry would be inexperienced. Others might be concerned or apprehensive about the upcoming assault and thinking about things other than tail rotors, so landing and trail greatly reduce an accident. The other formation that we used would be actually going into a landing zone. That would typically be a V formation. And the reason for that is that the V formation provided the pilots with an unobstructed view of the landing zone on final. It also provided the door gunners with overlapping fields of fire. The typical assault, we would bring five Hueys into the landing zone in V formation at one time. And that worked, obviously, as long as the landing zone was large enough to accommodate five Hueys at once, which took a pretty good size area. Minimum size area might be 3/4 the size of a football field. You would want something actually larger than that. There were all kinds of potential landing zones that large in the coastal plain and in the valley floors back in the hills. If we were making the assault to a ridgeline or a hilltop, there was seldom enough room to land five Hueys at once, in which case you'd put as many on the ground initially as possible. Actually, sometimes that would be exactly one helicopter. If we were making the approach to a single ship landing zone on a ridgeline or a hilltop, the troop carrying aircraft would get into a loose trail formation. The pilots would time their approaches so that as one helicopter was leaving the landing zone, the next helicopter would be on short final to the landing zone. The whole object being to get the infantry unit on the ground as quickly as possible.
All right. You mentioned earlier door gunners for your aircraft. What sort of armaments were your helicopters equipped with?
On our troop-carrying aircraft, the door guns were M60 machine guns, but they were not handheld. They were mounted on a pedestal. That actually worked quite well. The door gunners could swivel the door gun right or left or up or down, but that mount absorbed all the recoil of the weapon. So the door gunners could fire a long, very well-controlled string of shots without any problem. The door gunner on the right side of the aircraft was the aircraft crew chief. So he was a trained mechanic, and actually the individual helicopters were assigned to a particular crew chief rather than to a pilot. And serving as a door gunner was a duty the crew chief had in addition to serving as a crew chief. The door gunner on the right side of the helicopter was sometimes trained as a crew chief, and he was essentially waiting for one of the crew chiefs in the unit to rotate home so he could get his own aircraft. Some of the right side door gunners were prior infantry also. The Army had a program whereby if you went back to the United States from your tour in Vietnam with less than, I believe it was 6 months of time left, you could get out of the Army right away as opposed to the end of your obligation. Some of the infantry would essentially extend their combat tour beyond a year, fly as a door gunner for a while in one of the assault helicopter companies, and then when they rotated home, they would get out of the Army right away.
All right. So I guess the next thing that comes to my mind then is, along with your weapons, obviously you're fighting against an enemy. What sort of dangers did they present? As in, like, did you ever take fire from the ground? Like, what kind?
Yes. aircraft that I was never shot down, aircraft that I flew and certainly took hits. So, but I would also comment that that was less of a problem than the popular literature would seem to indicate. There are way more in the way of hot LZs where aircraft are taking fire on a combat assault in popular literature about Vietnam than actually took place in Vietnam itself. It happened, but it happened way less frequently than it did in books. We took most of our hits on the single ship missions that really weren't involved with a combat assault. So the logistics flights, for example, where we were hauling food and ammo or whatever out to the infantry all day, that's probably where most of our bullet hits occurred. They were almost always 30 caliber bullets, and people just taking pot shots at you, basically.
And what kind of protection did the helicopter provide? Like, were there armored sections, or?
There were. All the crew members wore a chest protector that everybody called a chicken plate. It weighed about 20 pounds or 22 pounds and would stop a rifle bullet. So the pilots and the door gunners wore a chicken plate. The pilots also sat in an armored seat, and the entire seat was armored. It also had a side panel on the outside of the seat, so it'd be on the left side of the seat for the left side pilot and on the right side of the seat for the right side pilot that you would slide. That pretty much protected your head also. So the pilots were better protected from that standpoint than the door gunners. The door gunners often sat on a second chicken plate for obvious reasons.
All right. Well, just to go back a little bit, what sort of things did they train you at all for, like, the eventuality of getting shot down? Like, what sort of things how did you respond to something like that?
Well, they didn't really train you to being shot down, per se. In flight school, we had very excellent training about with respect to what would happen if you lost an engine, for example. And there's a maneuver in a helicopter called an autorotation that you have to demonstrate the ability to execute properly that basically allows the aircraft to get on the ground if the engine stops running while you're flying. The training in flight school was really quite excellent. The first half of that or so was called Primary Flight School. That's where you really learned to fly a helicopter. Yeah, I was at Fort Walters, Texas. And you learn to fly a helicopter in small observation type helicopters, two or three place helicopters. And once you passed your primary check ride, you would travel with your flight school class from Fort Walters to Fort Rucker, Alabama. And there we received tactical training, we received instrument flight training, we transitioned into the Huey that most of us would fly in Vietnam. The instructor pilots at Fort Rucker were really outstanding. Most of them were returning combat veterans. They knew exactly what we would be exposed to when we arrived in Vietnam. Very excellent training.
All right. I guess the next thing then would be, I just wanted to talk a little bit about base life. So after you were done flying a mission or before flying a mission, what sort of things would you need to do to prepare your aircraft for the eventual, liftoff and execution of your next mission?
Okay, the actual daily maintenance on the aircraft and so forth was the responsibility of the crew chief. The pilots, unless they wanted to, and some of the pilots would get involved in helping that. The warrant officer pilots had secondary duty assignments. They really were secondary. Your primary duty was to fly, but we all had some sort of secondary duty. In my case, it happened to be the assistant operations officer. Some of the other warrant officer pilots were assigned an aircraft, and some of them would get involved in assisting with the maintenance and so forth. As far as what we did in recreational sort of time, if you want to call it that, the unit was stationed on a base camp, pretty Spartan primitive living. We lived in tents, we had a community shower, we had a latrine that mounted to a three-holer on the side of the hill. We drank a lot of beer, we played a lot of poker, that sort of thing.
All right. Did your base ever come under attack? Did you ever have exposure to enemy fire while you were on the ground?
Yes, we were mortared. I don't know that our particular base was ever attacked on the perimeter at all. And actually, one of the better missions we had would be the division having some sort of intelligence that LZ English, for example, might be mortared. And in that case, they would try to move the helicopters to a safer area. So we would sometimes fly our helicopters from LZ English to Quinyan. And that was a good deal for us because we would land at the fixed-wing landing strip they had at Quinyan. We would get to go to the Air Force Officers Club and use flush toilets and all kinds of neat stuff that was a treat.
All right. Well, what's just out of curiosity, what was the range of most of the missions that you flew? Because, I mean, everything's limited, of course, by fuel. Like, what would be, like, say, the maximum range of a mission that you might fly in a day?
They were really quite short. And, of course, the reason for that is that the 1st Cavalry Division did its level best to keep the infantry within range of artillery, so they had artillery support all the time. And the maximum range of a 105mm artillery shell is only 7 miles. So if you look at my flight records as an example, I logged my first flight time in Vietnam on May 11th, 1967. During the rest of May and the month of June, the 50-day period, I logged 229 hours of flight time, but what's amazing is the Hueys that I flew in logged 1,122 landings. So if you average that out, it amounts to 4.5 hours of flight time per day, 4 to 5 landings per hour. So these missions that we're flying are really quite short. They're 10, 15-minute flights, something like that on average. You would haul cargo out to a landing zone, drop it off and come back and so forth. And there might be 25 minutes, a half an hour total involved going out and back. So relatively short flights, relatively low altitude, although you would try to get above at least 2,000 feet above the ground so that you were less vulnerable to small arms fire.
All right. What would you say is the probably the largest operation that you took part in over the course of the war?
Well, I guess the largest one that comes to mind had to do with Khe Sanh. Towards the end of the Khe Sanh, after 68 Tet, there was a combined operation that involved the 1st Cavalry Division and the Marines. It was called Operation Pegasus. And I believe the initial assault there involved moving a battalion of infantry in one lift. There were a huge number of Huey helicopters involved. I don't know exactly how many, but there were a lot of them involved. The typical combat assault, however, involved moving a company-sized infantry or unit of infantry using 5 troop-carrying aircraft escorted by 2 helicopter gunships, and we could take 35 infantry into the landing zone in one lift because each helicopter would have 7 grunts on board. So if you were going to move a company doing that, you would make 2 or 3 lifts into the landing zone depending on how up the full strength the infantry unit was. And we might complete that in, 45 minutes or something like that. Hmm.
Did you ever participate in like any sort of medevac operations, like where you went instead of like say from base to, you know, like did you ever actually just carry wounded soldiers back from the battlefield?
We did, but that was a very secondary mission for us, and the reason for that is that the medevac missions were for the most part conducted by air ambulance Hueys. They were the same aircraft that we flew, except rather than having door guns and door gunners, they had combat medics in the back. They were attached to a medical unit. They were unarmed. Call sign was dust off. The pilots were trained to know which MASH unit to take a wounded soldier to. And of course, the guys in the back had the training and the drugs and the plasma and so forth to provide a guy with advanced life support or advanced first aid on the way back to the medevac pad. So when we made a medevac, it was usually just because we happened to be there and there was a wounded individual, mostly lightly wounded individuals that needed to go back. I would say the mission that we most likely made a medevac would be the emergency supply missions at night, because the reason we were going out there in the first place had to do with contact with the enemy, and we were already there, so particularly if there were lightly wounded involved, we would sometimes haul ammunition out and then bring wounded back and essentially make a medevac on the way back. But most of the medevacs were done by air ambulance that were specifically did that sort of action.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit more about Tet, if you don't mind. Just kind of in general, like what, after the initial attacks and after everything started to kind of go down a little bit, like what sort of reaction was there, like at least from your experience?
Well, of course, at the company level, as a warrant officer pilot, we didn't know Tet was coming, although that's certainly the reason 2/3 of the division moved from two corps up to the vicinity of the demilitarized zone. And there's no question we flew a large number of combat assaults around Wei and also around Quang Tri City, mostly in the coastal plain area between the DMZ and Wei. Our base camp there at Camp Evans was mortared. The roads were cut for a while, so we were resupplied by C-130s dropping food and ammunition and so forth out the back. But from the standpoint of simply flying as a warrant officer pilot with an assault helicopter company, we weren't privy to the overall major operations. I know a whole bunch more about why we did things at that time now than I did then, just having read books and so forth about 6810 and Quezon and what happened in that area.
All right. So was there any kind of a special, I mean, I know we talked a little bit about the Marines earlier. Was there any sort of special relationship at all between your helicopter company and the Marines? Did you ever participate in joint operations with them?
Oh, we sure did. The major joint operation would be Operation Pegasus. And again, all the coordination that took place was at a level far above the Assault Helicopter Company. Our operations at the company level were really with First Cav soldiers, period. So as far as I know, we never transported Marine soldiers on our helicopters. They were always First Cav.
Okay. All right. Well, let's just stop there for a sec here. All right. This is a continuation of the interview with Richard Berry. So I just thought of a couple of questions here. Mostly, I just wanted to talk to you about your experiences as a door gunner. I completely forgot about that when I was formulating my questions the first time. How was flying as a door gunner, I guess, different from being a pilot? Like, what sorts of things did you have to look out for?
Well, obviously, it's a completely different operation. It's one of the reasons I did it. I certainly did not have to serve as a door gunner as a pilot. What I would do would be to find a door gunner who had been flying often when I had a day off, and I'd suggest to him that, you know, if it's okay with you, I'll just sit behind your gun today. The crew chief on the helicopter, the other door gunner, would fly because he had other responsibilities beyond just being a door gunner, while I served with as a door gunner. And I was simply interested in what it was like to fly as a door gunner as opposed to a pilot up front. So you listen to what the pilot is telling you to do. The rule of engagement for our door gunners was that they did not fire their weapon unless we were fired upon. And even beyond that, if there was enough time, they would receive the permission from the aircraft commander before they would fire their weapon.
Okay. So just in terms of like operating the weapons involved, did you during your basic training receive training with the M60 door gun, or did you?
No, the only training I had weapons wise was I qualified with a M14 in basic training. In flight school, they had us qualify with 45 automatic handgun. When we arrived in Vietnam, they issued us 38 revolvers, which I had never fired in the military prior to that. I had no specific training with respect to the M60 as a door gunner. I just sat behind the gun. I knew basically how the weapon worked and what I was supposed to do to fire it, but I had no training on it.
Okay. All right. To talk a little bit more, we didn't really get a whole lot into variations on models of helicopters, but I wanted to talk a little bit about the C model Huey. How, in terms of like weapon specifications or just like overall differences, how did it differ from the Huey that you flew?
Okay, the Slicks had a larger cargo compartment. They came in kind of two forms, a D model and an H model. I flew both in Vietnam. When I arrived in the company in Vietnam, we were equipped with D model Hueys. They had a good sized cargo area, 1100 horsepower engine. And about halfway through my tour, they were replaced with H model Hueys, the only difference being a larger engine. So we had a 1400 horsepower turbine as opposed to an 1100 horsepower turbine. That extra 300 horsepower was really useful, particularly when you were flying in the hills and you were making landings to elevated areas. C model Huey was quite different from the D and the H model. It had a smaller cargo compartment. The door gunner on an H model or a D model, a Slick, sat in kind of an alcove next to the transmission with his door gun in front of him. The entire cargo area was open for cargo, for hauling troops and so forth. The C model did not have that alcove, it just had the cargo area, and that's where the door gunner was located. The C model had a different rotor system. It had what was called a 540 rotor system, which, and it entailed a wider rotor blade. So it could lift more, but couldn't fly as fast. And one of the problems with the C model gunships is they often had problems keeping up with the formation of slicks. As far as the weapons they had for them, they typically would carry two seven-round rocket pods on the outside, on the inside. Then outside of the rocket pods there would be machine guns, either two M60s on each side or one minigun on each side. The minigun's a six-barrel, 30-caliber machine gun. Actually, one minigun would fire either 2,000 rounds per minute or 4,000 rounds per minute. The M60s were more like 600 rounds per minute. The left seat pilot in the C model was the pilot that would operate the machine guns. So he had a sight, and he could move the machine guns right or left, up or down, so he could essentially aim the machine guns. The right side pilot in a C model would fire the fixed ordnance, the rockets. And the way he would shoot those rockets would be he would have to aim the entire helicopter in order to fire the rockets, because they were fixed and you'd simply aim the whole aircraft to fire them. The rockets were unguided once they left the tubes. They functioned about like a small artillery round or a mortar round when they struck the ground.
All right. Well, to get a little bit more into just your service, you talked a little bit yesterday after the first interview about some of your other duties while you were stationed over there, about, you know, your picture taking excursions in a way. Can you just describe sort of what you did? Sure. Other than fly the helicopters?
One of the benefits, actually, of serving as a warrant officer pilot as opposed to a commissioned officer pilot is that the primary duty of the warrant officers was to fly, whereas the commissioned officers flew, of course, but they had secondary duties that were almost primary. For example, the best example is our company commander. Our company commander was a major, outstanding gentleman by the name of Gene Beyer. I am still in email contact with him. An excellent pilot. He was on his second tour in Vietnam. He would ask us to do absolutely nothing that he wouldn't do himself. Outstanding leader, but he was not rated based upon his ability to fly. His officer ratings were associated with how well he managed A Company 229th. The officer complement of an assault helicopter company like ours would be a major as the commander. There would be a captain as the executive officer. He often served also as the maintenance officer. And then there might be four or five first lieutenants, an operations officer, a safety officer, and flight leaders. And then maybe 40 warrant officers. So the largest number of pilots in the company were warrant officers. And really, your primary duty was to fly. We often had secondary duties also. In my case, I served as the assistant operations officer for the company, but that really didn't involve a heck of a lot of work. 95 or more percent of the work associated with operations was done by the operations officer or first lieutenant rather than myself.
Okay. Just in terms of the things that you sort of had to do as the assistant operations officer, I know you talked a little bit about actually having to go kind of to the new site of your LZ. What was the purpose of that?
Well, the purpose of that from the standpoint of the company was to simply move the few vehicles that we had as part of our company. And we had a number of Jeeps and a few three-quarter ton trucks. And we needed to get those vehicles from LZ English, where we were stationed before we moved, to a place called LZ Evans, which was north of Way, farther north. And the way that worked is we loaded the vehicles onto Air Force C-130 four-engine cargo planes. They flew from LZ English north to a place called Fubai, which is just south of the old Imperial Capital Way. We unloaded the vehicles from the C-130s and then just had a little convoy on Route 1. And we drove the, I don't know for sure how far it was, maybe 30 miles or so north through Way to LZ English, which was, LZ Evans, which was going to be our new base camp in I Corps. And that's where we set up.
All right. Again, I've reached the end of my questions, but I'd like to thank you on tape this time. I forgot to do that last time, but thank you so much again for
That's no problem. For helping. I'm very happy to help.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thank you so much.